Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. We should know that personal finance isn't about being rich or getting rich quick. It's about buying independence and freedom of choice. You are not alone as you struggle with being the perfect wife, mother, daughter, daughter-in-law, and all the other traditional roles assigned to us by our culture. These pressures can feel overwhelming, and when we add the demands of a career on top of it all, many women choose to pass on dealing with money issues until they're forced to, and that's not the best time to learn. Here we explore the stories of women and how they've handled the demands of finances, family, and career. We talk about falling short of perfection, but also about the lessons we've learned and the best advice our peers have to offer for financial security and putting our perceived failures in their proper place. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Dr. Cynthia West. After spending most of her life in Western Pennsylvania, Dr. West relocated to Central Pennsylvania in 2015. Her education, medical training, and professional career have taken Dr. West from Erie, where she obtained her undergraduate degree at Gannon University, to Thomas Jefferson University School of Medicine in Philadelphia, where she received her MD. Dr. West completed a residency in internal medicine at Mercy Hospital in Pittsburgh and fellowship training in nephrology at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Following completion of training, Dr. West remained in the Pittsburgh area to practice nephrology. She is board certified in internal medicine and nephrology and was the medical director of a dialysis clinic in Washington, Pennsylvania. Several years ago, Dr. West discovered a passion for the philosophy and practice of functional medicine as a means to prevent chronic disease. Dr. West believes her experience in treating chronic conditions combined with a functional medicine approach provides her with a unique capability and perspective on what she believes to be the medicine of the future. Dr. West feels strongly that education is fundamental to prevention and greatly enjoys her role of teacher-doctor. Welcome, Dr. West.
Thank you, Lynn.
So let's talk a little bit about functional medicine, because I just think in my conversations with you offline, so to speak, functional medicine is what appears to be the way to go for the future. So first, let's start by defining it. What is functional medicine?
Well, functional medicine, according to the byline that it has been given by the founding fathers, is what's called root cause medicine. And once you get into it, you sort of understand what that is. But on the surface, that doesn't tell you much more than the term functional medicine, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Basically, functional medicine is doing a deep dive on a condition or symptoms to determine the underlying cause of those symptoms and conditions and treating the underlying cause. We often describe it as if you have leaves on a tree that are turning yellow, you can spray them green and make it seem all fine and blend in with the rest of the tree and mask the problem with the leaf, or you can determine what's wrong with the tree from the roots and treat what is wrong with the roots and therefore help correct the condition that's turning that leaf yellow.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I like that analogy. That's a good one.
So we take what we know of traditional medicine, and you know, everyone has a different philosophy, even, you know, traditionally trained physicians as I, everyone has a different approach. But I think by and large, we we like to say we have the 50,000 foot view of traditional medicine. We try not to lose the forest for the trees, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's amazing, having been trained traditionally and for so many years, really doing what we were told was the right thing to do. And I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do, but realizing at some point we were just sort of putting Band-Aids on many conditions and sticking our finger in the leaking dike, and sort of truly believing that we were fixing the problem. But in fact, we're really not fixing the underlying problem. That does require a little bit of a different undertaking.
And how did you discover this, and why did you decide to pursue this?
Well, a number of years ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday, I was walking into an exam room in my nephrology practice thinking, if I have to say these same words over and over again, they may as well just put a cutout of me and hit the tape button. And I actually don't even need to be here, because I was saying the same thing to most of the people I saw over and over. Yeah. And I thought, okay, so why don't these people know this? So I started to ask questions that were aside from the medical questions of the day for them, and really discovered that there was a huge knowledge gap. You know, medically, we knew what the problems were, and many times even knew what the causes were. But there was this huge gap. The patients didn't know, and they were the ones being affected. So it occurred to me, so if they knew this long before they ever got to my office, they might never need to be in my office. And as physicians, shouldn't that be our role? We are to, you know, are we treating health or are we treating disease? And by the time people got to me, we were treating disease. Health was long gone. So I thought, well, okay, I really can't go on for, you know, the rest of my career, now that I've sort of discovered this, slapping a Band-Aid on things and adding another medicine to a long list, realizing I'm really not making anybody actually better. I'm just treating another sign or another symptom. So I started to explore what was available in terms of treating what is the majority of the root cause, which is lifestyle. And I stumbled across the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, just, you know, by doing Google searches. And the ACLM was very new at that point, only a couple of years in existence. And I was thrilled to find, oh, my gosh, there are other people that actually think this way and are passionate about trying to, you know, take the baby steps to make these changes in our approach to patients and in our approach to treating their health. So I actually started the journey in the lifestyle medicine camp. But in the process, in my Google searches, kept coming across this Institute of Functional Medicine website. And I never really clicked on it. I thought, what the heck is functional? That doesn't make any sense to me. So I would, you know, I just click past it and not even look at it. And finally, I got incredibly frustrated that this kept being at the top of all the Google searches.
It's haunting you.
It was haunting me. So yes. I clicked on it and I explored their website a little bit. And much to the, I had the same reaction you did. Huh, this makes sense. So, I wonder what this is all about. And I actually needed some continuing ed credits and thought, you know what, I'm going to go to one of these conferences and see what this is like. I mean, what can it hurt? So I chose the next one that was available and attended. It's rather an intense module, the one that I chose to attend. I sort of went out of order from the recommendations and sat at this module scraping my jaw off the table over and over again, just thinking, oh my gosh, I mean, this makes so much sense. It's hurting my brain. There's so much knowledge getting forced in and actually brought out from things that I had known and long forgotten from med school.
Yeah.
That I often tell people it was one conference and I never looked back. You know, it was like, wow, I want to be a part of this.
And so how did that, how were you able to integrate that then with the traditional medical practice that you were running at that time?
Well, it was almost not possible to do that.
Yeah.
I did what I could within the construct of what is the traditional visit. You know, I was a subspecialist, so, you know, I got 15 minutes for a visit as opposed to the 5 or 10 that primary care got. Mm-hmm. So I did my best in the amount of time that I had to just take tidbits of what I knew, you know, little snippets and mini bites to present to people as it applied to their condition. And what I found was that people wanted this information. They were excited to hear these things.
I was just going to say that. How was it received by patients? Apparently, it was like a breath of fresh air.
For many, many people, it was,
yes.
Oh, my gosh, this is the kind of thing I want to know. Now, not everyone. There's mm-hmm. certainly not, you know, not everyone drank the Kool-Aid, as you might say. And some just said, yeah, you know, that's, I'm really not interested in undertaking changes to the degree that you're talking about. But, you know, it was an education for me to learn what they didn't know. And it was an education for them to even learn a little bit of what I had found out. So it was definitely a win-win, but not something that could be accomplished in that setting. That just wasn't practical.
And what kind of results did the people get who decided to opt in to what you were talking about?
Well, they would frequently come back saying, you know, I tried what you said and, oh, my gosh, I feel so much better. Or, you know, this problem has actually improved. I mean, understanding I couldn't employ, you know, the full tilt. But just the little things, I was encouraged by the fact that I was seeing people come back and say positive things about even small recommendations that I had.
Did you get any pushback from your colleagues? I'm guessing yes.
I was an old timer in the group.
Ah, okay.
So they would just roll their eyes and say, and there she goes again.
Yeah.
Nobody said, stop doing this, or there was definitely not that kind of approach.
Okay.
By no means. But I would get, here she goes. She's off the edge again. You know, so it was pushback in that sense.
Well, didn't any of them recognize that you seemed to be having some success?
Oh, yes.
and they wanted to know what the magic bullet was?
No.
Oh, all right.
They knew that there were patients who only wanted to see me and who would ask them about things that I had talked to them about. And they would frankly tell them, you got the wrong doctor this time. Because we rotated, you know, who saw which doctor at any given visit. So they would say, yeah, you're going to have to save that one for the next time you see Dr. West.
Okay. So... Then, at some point, about 5 years ago, you left your practice.
Oh, no, I didn't leave my practice.
Okay.
That was the lesson learned.
Okay. That, very good. Then what did you do differently with that information you have as far as how your practice expanded? Did you start a business of your own?
I started... a shadow business. It was actually in lifestyle medicine. And I sought the advice of a sort of a business mentor and flew out to Denver to spend a day with him, which, you know, he had a whole protocol for evaluating physicians who were looking for second careers. That's how I found him. And he became my guide towards establishing what I thought was a no-brainer for business, a lifestyle medicine option for employees. To this day, it makes perfect sense. It's still in its infancy, but the idea was, how about if we identify your top insurance cost drivers and take the employees who have those conditions and work with them to modify their lifestyle? Because we know that that's going to impact their chronic disease, which is therefore going to impact your bottom line when it comes to insurance.
Yep.
So, I mean, doesn't that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
So I started a practice of my own on the side while I continued my nephrology practice. Now, I did cut back a little bit. I went basically half-time with the nephrology practice and tried to develop the lifestyle business. And therein, the next step is probably the topic or one of the topics you want to talk to me about, I suspect.
Yes.
Because it became a financial issue for me.
Okay. So apparently it wasn't that readily accepted by the population that you were hoping it would be accepted by.
That's correct.
Okay. Do you think you were a little ahead of your time?
Well, in retrospect, a very good friend of mine who, you know, kind of just stood by me and supported me along the way said, you have the right idea. I think you're just ahead of the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably correct.
Probably it is. But I think that I've seen in the world that I've been functioning in, I've seen some people who have what we might consider to be peripheral types of medical advice. And I'm thinking about people who teach yoga, people who do things like that, that are designed to help with employees and helping them to be better human beings, I mean physically better and mentally better. They've been getting contracts with corporate employers to do these kinds of things in-house. So
correct.
I think there is a greater understanding of something that's a little off to the side, that's not traditional practice of medicine, that has some great value to the people who are looking for it.
Absolutely.
So perhaps, I'm not saying you should start all over again, because you probably don't have the energy to deal with that. But I think you're probably right. I've been through this myself where I wanted to do something that I thought was perfect and made a whole lot of sense to a lot of people, but the timing was off. It was simply there weren't enough people to understand what it was before I could launch into having it actually be a business. So I think it was a valuable lesson. And I hope you see it that way.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. So that may be a perfect segue into the other piece of this, which is that I'd love to talk to you about the financial aspects of your life and the questions that I sent to you ahead of time that I think they make it, they clearly have an impact on how, as adults, how we function with our relationship with money. So let's start with what your family was like when you were growing up. Were you an only child? Were you? Did you have other siblings?
Yeah, I'm the youngest of three. I have two older brothers, and mm-hmm. my father, I grew up in western Pennsylvania, and my father worked at a steel mill, mm-hmm. as many, many, many people in western PA did at that time.
Yeah.
My mother, was stayed in the home and did, you know, everything. So I sort of had the traditional, you know, Western PA upbringing.
Okay. And so what was your first memory around money?
Well, my entire memory about money really came from my mother, who, skipping forward to one of your other questions, was with hands down, without a doubt, the biggest influence on me. Mm-hmm. She grew up during the Depression and was the oldest girl in a family of multiple children. Her mother died when she was young, and therefore she was forced to drop out of school and stay at home to raise the children. And raise the children during the Depression with very little to go on. And her, the impact that that had on her was then handed down really to the rest of us. But because I was the only girl in the family, I think I got a double dose. That money was, you should treat money as though it is always scarce. And as though you may not have any tomorrow. So I was raised, with the concept that we really didn't have extra pennies to spend.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. And what point in your life did you realize that that's not necessarily true?
I realized that probably in college.
Okay.
So as I, I left home and went to college, I began to see more of what was there. And at that point, I was given, a certain amount of money per month, to support me through college. So I then had to, figure out how to use that. And
so did your parents pay for you to go to college?
No, it was a combination. I took out as many loans as I could, and then they supported, the rest, what made up the rest.
Okay. And then you went to medical school?
And yes.
And then did you pick up the cost of all of that yourself?
Again, I did take out I would maximize my loans, and then they would send, money each month for, food and things like that.
How did your mom feel about you going away to medical school?
Well, my mother's dream, I would have fulfilled her dream had I gone to nursing school, became a nurse, and stayed in Western PA to work at the local hospital. My mother always said that the greatest thing you could do was to take care of someone else.
Okay.
And so going to nursing school there where I grew up, she would have been tickled beyond all telling. Mm-hmm. So when I decided I was going to med school, she about lost her breath because this was, obviously nursing school on steroids. So she was beside herself.
A good way or bad way?
Oh, in a good way. All in a good way.
Okay. Okay. And so she was very proud of her daughter, the doctor.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So what was it that motivated you to become a physician rather than a nurse?
That's a really good question. I never even considered being a nurse. I don't even know why. I mean, for considering how much she promoted that, it was never even on my radar screen.
Was there somebody that you really looked up to who was a physician, or where did the motivation come from? Because clearly, as we've talked, and we know we're in the same generation here, for a woman to be a physician was something that was a rarity at that time. You were maybe 10%, 20% at the most of your class.
Right.
So there had to be something that made you feel like this is going to be a struggle, but I think I want to do this because. So what was the motivating factor for you to say, I'm going to take this on?
Well, I have to tell you, I was fascinated by the science. And I didn't go to a big high school. But even the science that I was exposed to in high school started me off. And I was just fascinated by the knowledge that there was out there to be learned.
Okay.
And I guess I never thought about being a teacher. I went to undergraduate school, arriving at their door saying, I want to be in your pre-med program. I was also never raised with the thought process that there was something that I couldn't do.
Well, great. Yay,
except
that's
sports.
Terrific.
My brothers and my father were big sports fans, and they knew that, you know, I was not in the line when sports talent was being handed out during my formation. So they knew sports was not in my future in any stretch. But,
all right.
But I could learn. I was a good student.
Yeah, well, that's good. All right. So you had something going for you,
right? I had
right?
something going for me. So I was a good student, and I loved science, and I just never thought I couldn't do it.
Well, that's wonderful. That is really refreshing to hear somebody say that. So when you got to medical school, did you find any kind of resistance because you were a woman?
You know, if I did, Lynn, I was probably too stupid to recognize it.
Okay.
And I mean, the women were a minority at Jefferson. Actually, probably the biggest, even before Jefferson, in my undergraduate training, in my calculus class in undergraduate school, I was the only woman.
Wow.
So that was something.
Yeah. Is there a spotlight on you the whole time?
No. I don't know if there was or not. That's what I say. I was probably too oblivious to even be aware of it.
Well, that's great, though.
Yeah. And I think that maybe that was a positive thing. I didn't approach things kind of either feeling less than or having a chip on my shoulder. I mean, it just never occurred to me.
That's great. So then when you finished med school, then where did you go next?
Well, I went to Mercy Hospital in Pittsburgh to do my internship and residency. And again, there were three women in that residency class.
Yeah.
Somehow I was dubbed the queen. I don't know how I got that, but I was dubbed the queen.
Was that a good thing or?
I always took it with a kind of a good humor, you know,
okay.
Just a friendly tease. And while I was in residency, I had my first child. And trust me, that was not something that was seen at Mercy Hospital every day.
Yeah,
so
I can imagine.
I will say that I did feel pressure at that time to, that might be, and again, whether it was self-imposed or something that I had picked up from the outside, I really think it was self-imposed. I felt like I could not do any less than anybody else. And I could not use my pregnancy as an excuse for anything less than max.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were sometimes some quiet tears the fatigue and, you know, whatnot. But
so how many children do you have?
I have three.
Okay. And were they all like during the same time in your life where you always had an issue in the sense that you would never want to let anything slip through the cracks because of your pregnancies?
Yes.
Okay. So your children are how old now?
32, 30, and 25.
Okay, and now you have some grandchildren, too.
I do have four grandchildren.
And that's one of the things that you're most proud of in your life.
Absolutely.
Do they live somewhere close to you?
Well, my relocation a couple of years ago was kind of twofold. It was an incredible confluence of the universal energy to have a position in functional medicine in a location in Pennsylvania that was very close to where my children live. So
perfect.
My oldest daughter and three of the grandchildren live minutes away, and
nice.
My other daughter and grandchild only live an hour away. So it was
That's great.
The universal energies.
They line up, don't they?
They lined up, that's for sure.
What do you think has been the most threatening to your financial security?
Not keeping something that you mentioned in the introduction, kind of relinquishing, I don't want to say control, but relinquishing management of finances or not relinquishing, that's a kind of a strong word, but not continuing to participate. Deferring is a good word.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Not participating in the financial, familial financial decisions.
Mm-hmm. How did that show up in your life?
Well, as it turned, I mean, it's not that it had a negative impact, that's for sure. I mean, there were no huge financial disasters. They were more philosophical disagreements.
Okay.
And a lot of question marks in my mind of, wait, is this supposed to be, is this the way it's supposed to be? Or is this the best, you know, we can do? Or is there something, you know, so there were a lot of questions. However, as you stated, I couldn't put that on my plate as well. I was, you know, a career mother and a woman with a career and a mother, and I couldn't take that on as well. So I let it go.
What do you think as some of the best and the worst financial decisions you've made?
Ironically, the philosophy of you never know if you're going to have money the next day has made me a saver and has taught me, I think, not to spend beyond my means. So if those are decisions, that influence has been very positive in that regard. And I think probably the worst decisions were, as I stated, not keeping my hand in the active role of making those sorts of financial decisions and being cognizant of, you know, everything I needed to know.
Okay. What are the events that have happened in your life that you would describe as defining moments?
Well, certainly there was a defining moment embarking on a career in medicine. I guess I didn't realize at that time. As I look back on it, I just am amazed at the things that we did. At the time that we were doing it, it was not a big deal. So the making that decision, and not long after that, learning very quickly how to balance having what you want in terms of being a woman, in terms of, you know, a marriage and children, and what that meant to do it all, so to speak. Again, maybe self-imposed, but recognizing that somewhere under your clothes was like a Wonder Woman cape, and that was a very hard facade to keep up.
Yes, indeed it was.
I don't know if that's exactly answering your question, but
no, it is.
Those are times.
Yes. There are times when you just wanted to pack it all in and say, I can't do Wonder Woman. And so how did you get yourself out of
those? Well, I think one of my favorite lines was when my son was preschool age, we had recently moved at that point to a different neighborhood, and I needed to find a ride for him to preschool. And I was trying to find a carpool with some other mothers, which I have to tell you, I probably met more resistance from them than from men.
I'm sure you did.
Because it was sort of like, you know, you're the one working, you figure it out. Kind of. Got to tell you, I didn't get, there was no support going on there. But there was one woman in the neighborhood who did, she and I carpooled the children. And she was always so happy and so calm, and in the morning, I would pass her on the back road riding her bike while I was speeding off to work. And I would come home and say, I want to be like Rhonda when I grow up.
Yeah.
She has a great house. She has three kids. Her husband, you know, he's always traveling and makes all the money. And she's riding her bike in the morning. And I want to be like her. How did I go on? You just felt, you know, I had done too much and come too far, and I wasn't changing that at this point. So it was sheer determination. Put your head down and plow through.
Okay. Do you see yourself ever being retired?
not in the formal sense of not doing anything. Absolutely not. I would lose my mind. I have to always have something to do, and I have to tell you, that was another thing about the appeal to functional. This is something that when you have a good mastery of it, and granted, I am still somewhat of a novice, I'm certainly still learning, but this is a form of medicine that you can do long beyond the standard retirement years. It allows that sort of scheduling and intensity that, you know, it's not the same as a practice as we traditionally know it. So I don't look to myself to retire permanently and not do anything, you know, move to Florida and sit on the beach until I can't do it anymore or until I become ineffective.
Okay. I think most people I've talked to on these podcasts have had exactly the same response, because I think those of us who are really committed to what we're doing find it hard to just walk away from that and say we're done. In some ways, it's a permutation of what we were doing. It just looks a little bit differently, but it's more self-directed. It's more on your terms. And it's something that is probably never going to go away unless, as you said, somebody tells you, you can't do this anymore. So let me ask you one final question. It's not on your paper, and it's just because I'm curious to know this. What is the area of personal finance that you are most uncomfortable with?
Well, you tell me if this answers your question. At this point in my, now it may have been different had you asked me this 10 or 20 years ago. But where I stand now, the issue becomes, how do I know if I had to retire tomorrow, would I have enough money to live? Will I have enough? Which I think, as I say it, reflects back on the way I was, you know, the kind of the philosophy that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good point. Because sometimes I get crazy answers like, I don't know if I'm getting enough return on my money. Well, that's okay. That it's whatever the answer is that's there when I ask the question. That's why I didn't want to give it to anybody ahead of time. Mm-hmm. It's something that's on your mind, and that's really what I was curious to know about.
Yeah, when is enough, I guess.
All of you in my Power of the Purse community, these were invaluable insights and perspectives from Dr. Cynthia West, all of which can help you move your career, your life, relationships, and financial freedom forward. Thanks again, Dr. West, for your time and knowledge, and tell people, how can they reach you if they have some questions?
Well, I'm just going to give you my email. How does that sound?
That's fine.
It is Cynthia G. West, all lowercase, @gmail.com.
Great.
And thank you, Lynn, for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you very much. I think it's been great, and I really appreciate your willingness to do this.
Thank you so much.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.